Good evening. This is what? January the 2nd, 2008. The last time I gave a talk in Delhi was on September 2nd, 2007. The day before I had my near meeting with death on the way to Vrindavan. So it's what that's like, what, 4 months? So the reason we're having this conversation or having this talk is because as a result of Prem Kishore coming to my room with his wife and asking us different questions, came for a short visit, and 7 hours later I think he left. Turned into a little bit of a longer visit than he intended. So then he had many questions, and I gave answers, and the answers produced more questions. So whose idea was to have this? I think it was Sahasranetra, who's yes. Not here. His idea was to have this little meeting, but he's not here.
No, he's going for some sale of the city.
Uh-huh, yeah. It's okay. That's all right. So the topic of discussion is the Grihastha Ashram. So it's not a formal seminar because for various reasons. One of them is that because my health is not so good, but also it was the result of informal discussion. So we'll keep it also in that level of a formal discussion, of an informal discussion about the subject of Grihastha life. All right. First of all, we should consider why would people want to get married in the first place? Why do we want to get married? What is the need to get married? If somebody says it's just for, like in the United States in the 60s, they were thinking, well, this is just a formality, it's a piece of paper, right? Because even now they want to have in some countries, and some countries already have it, same-sex marriage, right? In Canada, that's allowed. In Holland, so several countries, same-sex marriage is allowed. So, what is the need to get married? People were having sex before getting married. That's been happening quite a bit. Even in the Mahabharata, we find that Kunti, Devi, that Karna was born out of wedlock. And so many different things like this were happening. So it's not that marriage is required for this activity. Certainly the animals are teaching us that it's not required, that the animals are doing these types of activities continuously without the need for marriage. So we have to consider why is there marriage in the first place? When people start to begin to think about it, then we should think deeply. Why would we want to get married? It's because in Krishna's Vedic culture, the whole purpose, the worldview, is that we want to live in such a way that we can leave the material world. The whole point is to get out of the material world, right? Not to stay in the material world. The material world is a very dangerous place, full of suffering, I can assure you that I have a direct experience. It's full of suffering. Nobody has ever, I don't know anybody who's experienced continuous material pleasure for days on end, 24 hours a day. And you know anybody who's done that? But I have personally experienced pain for 24 hours a day for weeks on end. So I got the clue that Krishna is trying to tell me that the material world, the body, is meant for suffering. By direct experience. So the whole idea is to leave the material world. But because we are in the material world, and then our material bodies have got certain desires, various desires, how to fulfill those desires in such a way that it doesn't entangle us more in the material world. We have so many desires, so many things which are associated with the body, which if we don't fulfill them, creates a lot of problems. For example, we have to eat. Right? Are these going to be turned on or not going to be turned on? we have to eat. So how to eat in such a way that it doesn't entangle us? We can eat in a way which entangles us, or we can eat in a way which doesn't entangle us. Yeah, so the solution is we eat only yagna shishta, Krishna prasad. And there's so many, so that's just one. So all aspects of material life are like that. We can engage in them in a way which entangles us more in material life, or we can find a way which, by following that method, it takes us out of material life. You know, so if we have this for sexual desire, then there is grihastha ashram. Because Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that sex life, which is according to Dharma, is directly Krishna. It is not different from Krishna. So therefore, the grihastha ashram is the ashram where this type of activity is allowed, so that we can disentangle ourselves from material life, as the opposing thing would be to become more entangled in material life. So that's the important consideration, that the grihastha ashram is the way to get out of material life. That's the only reason it is existing. It's, because it's also in Krishna's, Krishna has created a certain culture. Everybody follows culture, but Krishna's got his own culture. He calls it Varnashram Dharma. Varnashram Dharma is a culture created by Krishna, so that he can experience rasa with everybody. That he's created a system, because he's rasa raja. He likes the exchange of feelings and emotions which can be there. Not just, parental. That's another exchange of feelings between friends and relatives. But the whole system, between student, he was a student. He was a student and his guru in the grihastha ashram. Of course, the grihastha ashram is so many relationships are there. That's where you have all of the rasas. Many of the rasas just derive from that. Madhurya rasa, Vatsalya rasa, all these, these are derived from that situation. But all of the, so that exchange of relationships is there because it's provided by the foundation of Varna Ashram. Even Parakiya Ras, which is found in Vrindavan, could only exist if there was a Grihastha Ashram. There wouldn't be any excitement unless there was a little illicit. How could it be illicit unless there was Grihastha Ashram? Right? So, of course, we know it's not illicit because Krishna's, he is Dharma itself, Dharman tu shakshat bhagavat pranitam. He creates Dharma, so it's not actually an illicit relationship. So Krishna set up the whole system of Varna Ashram. Daivi Varna, Varna Ashram is succinctly explained in the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Verses, I think it's 44 to 40, I can't remember exactly, but it's around there, 43, 44, 40, something like that, where he explains in a nutshell Varna Ashram. And then he explains Daivi Varna Ashram. And Daivi Varna Ashram, there's no difference between Varna Ashram and Daivi Varna Ashram in the performance of the duties. But just what is the purpose of the performance of the duties? That becomes Daivi Varna Ashram. The Daivi Varna Ashram is when one performs one's duties to please Krishna. That's the difference. Right? So if one performs one's Varna Ashram duties to please Krishna, then one goes back to Godhead. If one does it for the performance of duty, then one goes to Swarga. Because even persons what's his name? Who is the king of Magadha? Not Jayadrath. No. He was killed by Bhima. I'm thinking. Anyway, the people like Duryodhan, he followed Varnashram.
Jarasandha.
He perfectly followed Varnashram, but he was not following Daivi Varnashram. He was respectful to the Brahmins. It was because they came disguised as Brahmins that he respected them. So he perfectly followed Varnashram. But he was not doing it to perform, to please Krishna, not Daivi Varnashram. And these persons, they also get elevation. Otherwise, how they got their different powers by doing their different, they get certain punya by doing these different things. But the goal is different. They just go to Swarga. It's a temporary elevation, and then you come back down. The problem about Swarga is that while you're there, you can't do anything to keep yourself there. In the Mrityuloka, you can do punya, and that punya creates credit in which you can go to Swarga. But when you're in Swarga, you can't do anything to prolong your stay. You only stay as long, and then you use, when everything is used up, then you come back down. But you could perform, that's the problem with Swarga, that you have to come down, you have to leave the place. But in Daivi Varnashram, the point is to leave permanently the material world. This was explained, there was one Rishi, Mudgala Rishi. He wanted to know, he was a messenger from Swarga came to bring him back, to bring him to Swarga. And I think it was Aruna came, and he was going to bring him to Swarga. But before he went, he asked him, tell me about the benefits, the good things about Swarga, and tell me about the defects of Swarga. So here, all these different things are explained. Oh, everybody is so happy there, and this and that, and everybody wears a garland which never fades, and all these different things. Then he said, "Well, tell me about the defects of Swarga." So, well, defect of Swarga is that you can't do anything to stay there. It's temporary. When all your punya is finished, then you die, and just before you die, your garland fades, and then the terror that everybody experiences when they see their garland fading, because they know that they're going to die in the near future, is horrible. So this I count as a defect of Swarga, because the people, they know they're going to, they see that the garland wilting, they know it's very soon they're going to die. So this is a terror. So then he asked, okay, he says, I don't want to go there. he immediately said, I don't want to go. I'm not going with you. Now tell me about some other place where one doesn't fall from. And he explained the whole of about Vishnu Loka, going back to Godhead. So that's our goal. We want to leave the material world. We want to go back to Godhead. So the outline in Varnashram Dharma is explained in detail in the 7th canto, chapters 11 and 12, the explanation of a perfect society by Narada Muni explaining to Yudhisthira. That's in the Bhagavatam. There's some detailed information is there. A lot more detailed information will be found in the Manu Samhita. That is the law book for mankind. That is how to. Manu Samhita is the laws of how to run Varnashram Dharma. That is what the whole Manu Samhita is about. It gives a complete description of how to run a society. It's for Brahmins who study law, specialize in law, and for kings, because the kings have to make sure that, because one of the duties of the kings is to make sure that everybody is following Varnashram Dharma. So they have to know what Varnashram Dharma is, so they make sure everybody's doing it. And one of the five crimes, I can't remember all of them, five crimes which the king has to eliminate from his kingdom, one of them is adultery, assault, a theft, and I can't remember the other two, but they'll be very similar. No, I can't remember exactly. But the main point was adultery, because no varna sankara. Varna sankara was quite a major problem. Didn't want to have varna sankara. That's why in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the whole idea, the whole thing about that varna sankara is so bad, because actually it creates difficulties. The children become confused. But that varna sankara is not even out of adultery. That's out of, you know, out of patiloma and anuloma marriages like yayati and sharmishta. You know, he was kshatriya and she was a Brahmin girl. So that created a problem. Because, you know, he didn't want to marry her, but she wanted to get married to him. And he, you know, he created a problem for him. Because she had to, I will get into that, you know, the whole idea of marriage. In Manu describes that of all the samskaras, all samskaras are to be performed for the boys and also for the girls. Girls also have samskaras, except that when it comes to upanayanam, there's no upanayana for girls. For girls, their upanayanam is vivaha, is the marriage ceremony itself. And that's why girls, girls got married when they were very young. You see that at a young age, there used to be child, even today, there's still child marriage in India. But for various reasons. But the real reason was that boys, they got the upanayana, Brahmin, you know, boys who were sattvic, they would get the upanayana between the age of approximately, say, 6 to 8. Whereas kshatriya boys between upanayana from about 8 to 10. And vaishyas would get upanayana between 10 and 12, roughly speaking. Because those three varnas went to Gurukul. They got upanayana, not just Brahmins, kshatriyas, vaishyas. So, because the spiritual training begins at a young age, because the whole point of society, the worldview of the whole society is how to get out of the material world. So you don't wait till you're 25 to do this. You know, you start it as early as possible. So, if the boys have to start at that young age, also the girls. So for them, marriage also took place at that age. Of course, they may not be living with the husband until after puberty. But it's described how, see, the brahmacharis in the ashram, the guru, they would do their daily agnihotra, do a daily fire sacrifice. The grihasthas would do that. I was just reading last night how when Krishna was in, he came from Upaplavya, where Yudhishthira was, to try to negotiate the peace with Duryodhan and company. So he got up in the morning after he took all his bath. Then he did a yajna. All twice born men would do yajna. So brahmacharis would also do that. So what did the girls do? The girls, for them, cooking was their agnihotra. When the wife cooks, that's her agnihotra. She doesn't have to do separately agnihotra. So it's called the Grihastha Ashram. So we have to understand whose ashram it is. It's the boy who goes from the Brahmachari Ashram to the Grihastha Ashram. For Brahmins, there's 4 ashramas. For Kshatriyas, there's 3 ashrams. For Vaishyas, there's 2 ashrams. And for Shudras, there's only 1 ashram. So for Brahmins, there's all 4. For Kshatriyas, there's no sannyas for Kshatriyas. And for Vaishyas, there's no sannyas or vanaprast for Vaishyas. And for Shudras, there's only Grihastha Ashram. There's no Brahmachari Ashram. So when the Brahmachari goes from, he's, as a Brahmachari, he lives in the ashram of his guru. And what does he do there? He cleans the floor. He washes the guru's clothes. He does all menial services for his guru. Right? So that's why a good brahmachari makes a good grihastha. Because when he, the reason is that later when, if he wants to get married, then he enters the grihastha ashram, which means it's his ashram. It's the husband's ashram. And the wife enters into his ashram. She's the main student. It's not that it's not her ashram. It's his ashram. So why did I say a good brahmachari makes a good grihastha? Because he appreciates everything his wife does. Because he did the same things. He had to wash the floor. He washed the clothes. He chopped the vegetables. Not that his mother did everything. Not that his mother did everything and he didn't do anything. He just was playing on Xbox or whatever they do these days, you know. Not day. He had to do all the menial services. He realized, because the girls, they can understand what it takes to run a house. Whereas boys, they just think it happens by magic. You know, they're hungry, their mother already had the food is ready. By magic is all happening. No, by some mystic power. But then when they sent to the grihastha, and they sent to the ashram of the guru, then they can see what it takes. That it takes a lot of endeavor, a lot of organization to maintain a house, to maintain, you know, all the things which are necessary, all the work which is required. Because why do they recognize it? Because they're the ones who are doing the work. They're being forced to do it. They're being forced to do that manual service. But if a person doesn't spend time in the brahmachari ashram, they become shocked when they find out what is required. And then they don't appreciate what their wives are doing. Is that sometimes a complaint that the ladies have, that their husbands don't appreciate them? I sometimes hear that complaint, that the husband doesn't appreciate the work that the wife is doing, how hard it is to cook. It's because he's never cooked. He doesn't know, you know, he doesn't know how to make a chapati. He doesn't know how to boil water. Right? But then, if they've lived in the ashram, if the boys lived in the ashram, then they know how to do these things. So then they appreciate a lot more what is done. So an important point then is that it's the ashram of the husband, his ashram, and the wife is the main student. So this creates a certain things, certain expectations are there. First of all, what are the duties of the husband, and then what are the duties of the wife? So the main duties of the husband, it's not that just wives have duties and husbands don't have duties. Everybody, there's a tendency that everybody knows, they're very expert about what the other person is supposed to do. Right? They always are so expert. What the other people are, they know everything the other person is supposed to do. But they're not focusing on what they're supposed to be doing. You know, so we should focus more, find out what our prescribed duty is, and do that. And not be so concerned about what the other person's prescribed duties are, and be expert on their prescribed duties. We should be expert on our prescribed duties, and perform them. The reason is that even if the other person is not doing their prescribed duties, you still make advancement. Because we're doing it, remember, it's Daivivan Ashram. We're doing it to please Krishna. Doesn't matter if the other person is fulfilling their part, because we're doing it to please God. That's why it's described how Manu describes that even if the husband is sinful, or even if he finds pleasure elsewhere, I mean, the other has other women, that the wife should not criticize and should continue serving. Not that Manu is, you know, trying to suppress women. Because he recognized the husband is, he says, sinful. That means there's going to have karma. There's going to be a reaction for that person. He's got his own problems. But that the wife's criticizing of the husband is even worse. An even worse sin. than what the husband is doing, because it'll jeopardize her spiritual development. Just like in, I can't remember which canto it is, I think it's in the second canto, when Lord Brahma becomes influenced by Maya and becomes attracted to his daughter. So all the other rishis, they're seeing all these things. So Lord Brahma is a superior. So they didn't just start, like, you know, yelling at him and, you know, making protests. You know, they didn't, because he is their superior. So it's not in their position to criticize him. In fact, there's nobody they could go to, because he is the chief living entity in the universe. So all that they could do was very, you know, with folded hands, just, you know, submit, you know, like, you know, this, you're a very respectable person. How can you be doing, you know, this is not according to your station. You know, they spoke with him in a very humble way, because he is a superior. So they're in a very delicate position. But because he was a superior, he could understand his mistake, and he corrected himself. But, you know, because he has his elevated position. But it might not be the case with some, you know, some husband may not be elevated enough, you know, so still the wife should be careful not to criticize. She has to find some other means, you know, other ways of correcting. Or sometimes it's just a self-correcting situation. If there's other family members will get involved. Like Dayaram told me an instance, because he came from a Brahmin family. So his grandfather he kept a complete tight grip on the family, right? So he had several sons. And as long as he was alive, everything was going very, you know, according to his command. When he left his body, one of his sons was a drunkard. He would drink. And when he would drink, he'd beat his wife. Badly, beat his wife badly. So, you know, so the worst thing that a woman could do is argue with a drunken man. Most cases of spousal abuse, there's a bottle in the middle. The bucket is the other. Man, he's drunk. How can, there's no reason. They just make a person worse, and they'll just beat you. They can kill you. And my wife's aunt, her employment in Croatia was, she was a court stenographer. She recorded all the things that happened in the courts, and she's seen many in the courts of many horrible things, you know, where men or people killed their spouse. They were totally intoxicated. They didn't even remember what happened. They were so intoxicated, they killed somebody, they don't remember. So you don't want to argue with somebody who's intoxicated. So anyway, she told her sister-in-laws what happened. And naturally, they told their husbands, who were his brothers, what happened. So they told him, don't do this anymore. So then he did it again. So they took him behind the house, and they beat him half to death. And he never did it again. So somebody who is superior or equal can correct, but, you know, if the wife tries to correct, then it can be, it's not such a, not so, not recommended, not a recommended procedure.
That must, that means that wife should not correct husband if he's doing some wrong?
Well, in that kind of a situation, you know, you have to be cautious, because, you know, if that has a formula for disaster. The wife argues with a drunken husband?
Not drunken, husband is not drunkard. Maybe he's angry, or he's done something wrong, and the wife tries to correct her.
Well, it has to be done in a very, depends on a time, place, and circumstance. Just, for example, after Kunti had given birth to three children, Pandu tried to entice her for more, having more children. So then she gave so many reasons for why, you know. So then he accepted that. Then he said, okay, well, how about Madri? Like that, you know. So But it wasn't. It was done in a respectful way. You know, but it shouldn't be like one of my god sisters said regarding arguing with husbands: is the wife has to decide, does she want to be right or does she want to be married? You can't have both. You can't be right and married at the same time. Because if that happens enough times, then the husband, who knows what could happen, the husband can get very annoyed with that kind of attitude. But the wife always has to be right. You know, she, you know. Every situation has to be taken, you know, you have to see according to time, place, and circumstance, what is the situation? What is the nature of the husband? Is it, if you present it according to Shastra? For example, in the Mahabharata, there are many times where Draupadi gets on the case of Maharaj Yudhisthira, getting on under his skin, trying to get him to, you know, to, and not just her, both him, her and Bhima, trying to get on the case of Maharaj Yudhisthira, you know, to forget about this vow of living in the forest. Let's go kill all the Kauravas. They insulted me. She was really upset about. She was very upset. Draupadi was extremely upset about the, and for a good reason. It was not like what they did to her was not good. It was extremely bad what they did to Draupadi. You know, so she had cause to be upset. But she was, so she would argue, you know, very much with Maharaj Yudhisthira. But then he very calmly defeated her. because he was Dharmaraj. She presented, and she wasn't just, you know, speaking out of anger. She presented so much Shastric evidence. You know, according to this Shastra and this, that Shastra. And then Maharaj Yudhisthira would present a much higher reasoning, and she couldn't say anything because he knew Shastra better than anybody. He was Dharmaraj. He wasn't called that without a reason. And they had to, that's why they all obeyed him. They obeyed him because he knew what he was speaking about. So that was, you know, so she tried, and even Draupadi, she, you know, she was discussing like this with Maharaj Yudhisthira, but she would do according to, you know, very sweet. You know, she would use. He praised the way she spoke and this and that. Or there's a very nice instance in the Ramayana about an argument between Sita and Lord Ram, if you could call it. Technically, it was an argument. They were arguing over a point, but we should be so gracious as they were. So Agastya Rishi orders Ram and Lakshman to go kill all the Rakshasas in Dandakaranya. So they're walking, they're going to Dandakaranya. And Sita, you know, she tells, you know, she tells Ram, well, we haven't got any argument with these people, so why are we going to kill them? They never did anything wrong to us. But she didn't just say, like, you know, you haven't got any will of your own, you're just doing what these, you know, she didn't criticize Lord Ram. She didn't say, you know, why are you doing what this person's telling you? You know, damn, you got a mind of your own? Listen to me. Which is a sort of a self-contradictory statement. You know, why are you listening to him? You should listen to me. That's, you know, she didn't speak that way at all. She spoke, she was very self-effacing. She's very humble. And then she presented her case to Lord Ram. And then Lord Ram, what did he say? Did he say, oh, you're just a stupid woman, 32 ounces? No, he didn't say it like that. Lord Ram was very appreciative of what she said, because she spoke very nice. She spoke very sweetly. And he appreciated everything she said, that this is a symptom that you have great love for me, great affection for me, but you're wrong. But he also responded to her very nicely. Very calmly, very nicely, and it was a very sweet exchange, though you could technically say it was an argument, because they were arguing, they had contradictory views on the same point. But though it was an argument, it was a very sweet exchange. You know, we should be so, actually we are supposed to deal in that way. The two literatures which have, you know, not everybody reads Vedanta Sutra, not everybody is reading the Manu Samhita, you know, but the two literatures which have to this day been the bedrock of Vedic civilization has been the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. Because this is what everybody, they were designed for everybody. Mahabharata was designed for everybody to read. And all of the points of Dharma which are mentioned in the Manusmriti, they're all explained by example in the Mahabharata and in the, you know, in the Ramayana. How a wife deals with her husband, how a husband deals with his wife, how a son deals with his father and a father with his son, how a Kshatriya deals with Brahmins and Brahmins with Kshatriyas, all the different relationships, how an older brother with a younger brother. Lakshman and Bharat, they and Shatrughan, they all treated Ram as if he was God. How much older was Ram to Bharat? He was just one day older. And Lakshman and Shatrughan were only 2 days younger than Ram, because he was born on Punarvasu Nakshatra. Bharat was born in Pushya Nakshatra, and Lakshman and Shatrughna were born in Aslesha Nakshatra, which is just one after the other, just one day apart, like that. Yet they treated him as God. Of course, he was God. Of course, they also were God. But that's the respect they gave, because, you know, he was the older brother. So all these different rasas are all, you know, they're all explained, they're all demonstrated, even under difficult circumstances, how to behave, even under different difficult circumstances, because many, they're not ideal situations which are there. So that's another point, is that we do our duty even if the situation is not ideal, right? So sometimes in the Grihastha ashram, well, most of the time, in most situations, it's not ideal, but we still do our duty. So in different situations, there may be unpleasantness, or things may not be exactly perfect. Because, you know, the whole Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna's difficulty, that is not an ideal situation. He likes to kill. He's a warrior. You know, in the Mahabharata, you see Arjuna single-handedly went to war against, you know, tens of millions of asuras and killed them. The Navita Kavachas, he killed them. So he had no problem killing people. He didn't cry. He didn't get upset. Didn't get shaky knees. He just got exhilarated at the thought he's going to go out and do battle with these people. But the problem at Kurukshetra was that it was not an ideal situation. It was far from ideal, because he had to kill his grandfather. He had to kill his guru. He had to kill so many people who he actually had affection. He had to kill his own uncle. His old uncle, Shalya, was on the other side. He was tricked by Duryodhan, the brother of Madri. The father, the uncle of the twins, was on the other side. They had to kill him. And he loved them very much. So they had to, you know, so it was not an ideal situation. Still, to please who? To please Krishna, he did his duty. The whole of the Bhagavad Gita is to fulfill one's prescribed duty, or to please God. That's what the whole, you know, Krishna's, you know, many other topics are there, but to please Krishna, Arjuna fulfilled his prescribed duty under less than ideal situation. Under a very unideal situation. So, oftentimes, the Grihastha ashram presents less than ideal situations. Would that be correct?
Most of the time.
Yes, I hear a lot of complaints from both sides. So, we can start with some questions. I guess that was sort of a brief introduction. Any questions? Yes.
From how far this help reading helps our own attitude. Like, suppose I'm in mode of passion, and I'm reading all the good rules and regulations. But my mode of passion, how far this reading will help me and when I'm in difficult circumstances.
I was just hearing last night or the night before that Vishwanath Chakravarti was describing about the 10th canto, pastimes, you know, about Krishna and the gopis, that just by reading, hearing these pastimes destroys so many anarthas in the person, because they understand what is actually the highest goals of life and how everything that we do is ultimately futile. So it has, you know, or even we may not, the effect, there is a very dramatic effect on us, but it may not be immediately seen. Just like when, if you're ill, right, and the doctor gives you medicine, does it mean that as soon as the tablet hits your tongue, there's a cure? No. So by continually taking the medicine, then there's a cure is there. So we have two types of karma that we have in our life. That is, karma can be divided into two parts. Kriyamana karma, which is newly created karma, and Sanchinta karma, which is the sum total of our all past karma. So Sanchinta karma can be further subdivided into two parts, Arabdha karma and Prarabdha karma. So the Prarabdha karma is the karma which has been put into action. Suppose you went down to the fountain, there's a large body of water, and you take out a glass of water. That would be your Prarabdha karma. The rest, the Arabdha karma, is laying in potentiality. So by performing devotional service, it destroys all that potential karma. That's what is described in the Gita, that all the karma is burnt up like wood which is turned into ashes by the action of fire. Right? That's all destroyed. But the Prarabdha karma, which has already been put into action, doesn't get destroyed. It does not get destroyed. By the will of God, it doesn't get destroyed. Because if it were to be destroyed, then, you know, you die. This is proof. You just go look in the mirror. That's proof you have Prarabdha karma, your body. You know, that's Prarabdha karma. If it gets destroyed, then your body falls off. So it wouldn't be. So Krishna, you know, he's a very intelligent person, that he purposely does not allow that to happen, that bhakti is strong enough to destroy it, but it doesn't become destroyed, because Baladev Vidya Bhushan explains that then no one would be left to teach the Brahma Vidya, because as soon as they achieved it, then they would die. You know, that means at the time of the initiation ceremony, they said all the karma goes all to the guru, but all the Arabdha karma goes to the guru to get burnt up, but not your Prarabdha karma, because if it is a fact, then everybody at initiation ceremony would die, and who would be wanted to get initiation next? Oh, take off the dead bodies, you know, and it's not gonna be very popular. Not gonna be a very popular movement, of course. All, even the gurus, it doesn't become practical. It doesn't become a practical situation. But this whole, it's explained in the third canto. Let me see if I can find it. Where is my mouse? In the third canto, I think it's verse Yes. Here it is. It's chapter 28, starting around verse 34. It explains here. Okay, verse, this whole section, verse 34. Okay, so it says, so it describes how, I'll read the first verse, the verse, the previous verse. Thus situated in the highest transcendental stage, the mind ceases from all material reaction and becomes situated in his own glory, transcendental to all material conceptions of happiness and distress. At that time, the yogi realizes the truth of his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He discovers that pleasure and pain, as well as their interactions, which he attributed to his own self, are actually due to the false ego, which is a product of ignorance. This is, of course, Lord Kapiladeva explaining this to Devahuti. Then he explains, because he has achieved his real identity, the perfectly realized soul has no conception of how the material body is moving or acting, just as an intoxicated person cannot understand whether or not he has clothing on his body. So this is describing a Jivan Mukta, that the person is so spiritually enlivened that he is not even aware of whether or not he's got a body on. The body of such a liberated yogi, along with the senses, is taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's just like if you're driving and you're sitting beside the driver, but then all of a sudden the driver falls asleep. You have to immediately grab the wheel because he's asleep at the wheel. So this is what happened here. The body of such a liberated yogi, along with the senses, is taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because we read in the previous verse, he doesn't know if he's got a body or not. He forgot. He's not even aware of whether or not he's got a body. So Krishna has to grab the wheel of the car, you know. It is, because it is a car, don't forget. Maya, Rudani, no. Yantara Rudani, Maya, yeah. It is a vehicle. So Krishna is grabbing it. And it, so it's taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and it functions until its destined activities are finished. So it means the body of this yogi is now functioning only because of the Prarabdha Karma. The liberated devotee, being awake to his constitutional position and thus situated in samadhi, the highest perfectional state of yoga, does not accept the byproducts of the material body as his own. Thus he considers his bodily activities to be like the activities of a body in a dream. So this is the purport where Srila Prabhupada explains that the following question may be posed. As long as the liberated soul is in contact with the body, why doesn't the bodily activities affect him? Doesn't he actually become contaminated by the actions and reactions of material activities? The answer to such questions, this verse explains that the material body of a liberated soul is taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is not acting due to the living force of the living entity. It's not because the soul is in the body anymore. It is simply acting as a reaction of past activities. So that means that body is now working only because the Prarabdha Karma has been put into action. Even after being switched, even after being switched off, an electric fan moves for some time. That movement is not due to the electric current, but is a continuation of the last movement. So what we're seeing is the fact that the karma has been put into action, has been put into motion. It's just the continued movement. Yes, but the soul is not attached. He's not feeling the pain or the suffering. That's the whole point of the, in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. gives very concisely. Explains it in a slightly different way. In the perfect in the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous self state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of greatest difficulty. So, and this indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. So the point Krishna is speaking here is that when you understand who you actually are and become detached from the gross and subtle body, you do not experience pain or suffering. Because what is it that's suffering? Is it the soul which is suffering? It's the gross and subtle body that suffers, the mind, intelligent, and the body. That's what's suffering. So if you're attached to that, you suffer. If you're not attached to it, you don't suffer. It may be the gross and subtle body will suffer. Not that the suffering won't go on, but you're not the one who's going to be experiencing it. Because it's the point, he says, one is never shaken even in the midst of greatest difficulty. So it means things are going to happen. If you're going to get a broken leg, that's your destiny, you get a broken leg. But because you're not attached, you're not identifying yourself with your gross body, you will not suffer. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. Because as Kapila Deva is explaining, that yogi is not even aware of whether or not he's wearing a body. He's not even aware. Krishna has to take the wheel, has to take in charge of that person's body, because they're lost in their love of God. So getting to your point of your question is, reading, does it have a beneficial effect, even if you say you're in the so-called mode of passion? Yes, it does have a very positive effect, because it is directly, first of all, we see in the 18th chapter of the Gita, what does Krishna say? That simply by reading this conversation, one worships me with his intelligence. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's directly stated that by reading the Bhagavad Gita, it is directly devotional service to Krishna. So it definitely has an effect. Definitely has an effect. Imagine the faith Srila Prabhupada had to have in Bhakti Siddhanta. He had to have tremendous faith in Bhakti Siddhanta. To leave Vrindavan at the age of 70, you know, cross the ocean, have heart attacks, you know, it's tremendous risks. That requires tremendous faith in Bhakti Siddhanta. But at one point, Srila Prabhupada had doubts about Bhakti Siddhanta. Because one time he heard Bhaktisiddhanta ordering the killing of a snake. So he thought, how a sadhu can order the killing of a snake? That put a seed of doubt in his mind. And he never asked, he never mentioned, he never asked Bhakti, he never made any inquiry. Now, that doubt would have destroyed. How could he ever have so much faith in Bhaktisiddhanta? That was destroyed because Prabhupada read. He continued reading. He was always reading. So when he read prayers of Prahlad Maharaj to Nrisimhadeva in the 7th canto, and how Prahlad Maharaj explained how even the saints are happy if a snake or a scorpion is killed, so all his doubts were destroyed. So that's the effect of reading. You may not even understand, but it has a cumulative effect. Cumulative effect. Prabhupada explained what the speak of reading. So if somebody just touches my book, they simply touch his book. In fact, one of my godbrothers, who was a book distributor, said, because at that point, I don't touch any books by Narayan Maharaj. I won't even touch them, but to speak of read them. But if somebody just touches the book, keep the book, because the book is directly Krishna. Bhagavad Gita is directly the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's no difference between the two. So just having Bhagavad Gita in your house has an effect. We may not immediately be aware of the effect. It's like when you chant, when we chant the holy name, Krishna is there. We may not be cognizant of it, we may not see Krishna, but it has an effect. The more, you know, it has an effect on our consciousness. Krishna is directly there. So anyway, does that answer your question, Madhavji?
Not negative about reading. It's obviously most important activity. Chanting also. But as I see myself, in difficult circumstances, I'm in mode of passion or ignorance. As far as I'm reading the scriptures, definitely I'm getting some knowledge how I should be reacting. But when I see I'm failed to do so, so this way I
want
to check.
Okay, that's a good point. It's a very good point. Sometimes we get depressed. All right, we get depressed that
I'm not able to perform as the scriptures advises us to perform.
This is my favorite purport. It's very short, but this is my favorite purport in the Bhagavad Gita. You write this down. Chapter 3, verse 31. Those persons who execute their duties according to my injunctions and who follow this teaching faithfully without envy become free from the bondage of fruitive activities. So Krishna says, if you follow the rules I give you without envy, then you will become free from the bondage of fruitive activities, right? And then what does Srila Prabhupada write in the purport? The injunction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is the essence of all Vedic wisdom, and therefore is eternally true without exception. As the Vedas are eternal, so this truth of Krishna consciousness is also eternal. One should have firm faith in this injunction without envying the Lord. There are many philosophers who write comments on the Bhagavad Gita, but have no faith in Krishna. They will never be liberated from the bondage of fruitive action. But an ordinary man with firm faith in the internal injunctions of the Lord, even though unable to execute such orders, becomes liberated from the bondage of the law of karma. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord. But because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. So, we may not be able to do at the beginning. So what some people do is, oh, Krishna made all these rules, it's too hard, we should change the rules. You know, that was before. This is Kali Yuga. We can't, you know, they always have so many excuses. Try to lower the bar, the rules are wrong. No, the rules are right. We're wrong. Krishna is right, we are wrong. So we can't resent. Without resenting his principle, without resenting the rules that he made, you know, we have to accept the rules, even if we are not able to follow them. We say, Krishna is correct. We deserve to be punished. Krishna will appreciate that. But because one is not resentful of this principle, not resentful of Krishna's rules, and he works sincerely, without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. It's a multi-lifetime process. Right? It's a multi-lifetime process. So we have to continue, even if we... It's like, who has children? Anybody has children here?
Yes.
You have children. Okay. So when your baby was learning to walk, right? They got up for the first time. Did they immediately start walking? or that you fell down. Yeah, so this doesn't work. This process, this walking thing, it doesn't work. I'm just not going to try anymore. You know, no. The kid gets up, falls, gets up, gets falling over again. Eventually, I'm going to give this up. You know, it's not working. They may say it works, but it doesn't work. I don't believe this stuff. You know, no. The kid gets up and he keeps walking. We all did that. You know, one thing we hear about, you know, about Haridas Thakur and Vishvamitra. How Vishvamitra, you know, how he fell down because of Menaka, right? And how Haridas didn't fall down. But one thing we can learn from Vishvamitra Muni, yes, he fell down. But he stayed down. He got himself back up again. And he fell down again. And he picked himself back up. And he fell down again. And he picked himself back up. And he fell down again. And then he picked himself up again. To the point that he became the guru of Lord Ram. He arranged the marriage of Ram and Lakshman to Sita and Urmila. So yes, he fell, but he picked himself back up. He didn't give up. So as soon as you give up, you lose. As soon as you give up, you lose. But if you keep fighting, eventually you win. It's a war with Maya. So you have to keep fighting. There's no other choice. You don't have another choice. The other choice is samsara. Would you want to be around here for another 10 million lifetimes? It's a horrible. Spend 10 more million lifetimes in this world? No, we have to fight. Keep fighting.
Regarding you are saying we have to do our prescribed duties to please Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time we forget that thing. We have to please Krishna by doing our prescribed duties. And one thing is that even while doing regular activities, because we are Grihastha Ashram, so whatever activity we are doing that comes under prescribed duties as a husband, so I forget that I have to do my this duty to please Krishna. So how to do that? How to remember everything and doing the duties?
Suppose your spouse is, for some reason, you're upset with your spouse. Now this can be either way, husband or wife. Then if we start getting that, you know, so the spouse displeases us for the reason, then we think, oh, we're going to be revengeful or this. Or this just creates more displeasure. But if we remember, you know, because once things start getting unpleasant in the house, that should be a reminder that we're doing something wrong. Being unhappy means we're not in Krishna consciousness, right? If you're not happy, it means you're not Krishna conscious. So then once you realize you're not happy, then you know, what's wrong? Because I'm not doing my prescribed duty. So even if the spouse, for some reason, is displeasing you, I'm going to do my duty anyway to please Krishna. You know, so for a husband, the main duties are to provide for the wife and to protect the wife. Now, providing the wife, this, of course, includes, you know, home, shelter, food, clothing, but also, especially in more classic times, education. The wife is educated in the home of the husband. Not that she went to school; you know, she was educated. And like we see many the conversations between Shiva and Parvati. She's his disciple. She's asking questions. He's answering her questions. Well, I read a very nice biography of Raghavendra Swami. Raghavendra Swami was an important acharya in the Madhva Sampradaya. So before he became a sannyasi, he was married. And he was studying the Kumbhakona at the ashram there. And he's all his esoteric knowledge. When he would come home, and he would repeat the same lessons to his wife, because she was his main student. And he would teach her everything that he learned, he would teach to her. Because that, you know, and if she had, then there were children, and the wife is the Adi Guru of the children. So as soon as there's any, you know, when you realize that things are not going well in the family, then that's an indication somebody's not doing their prescribed duty. And if you become tempted not to do yours, that means you should do it anyway. Because if you realize you're doing this to please Krishna, that automatically makes you feel good that you're doing this to please Krishna.
One point is very important in this case, regarding prescribed duties. Like you are mentioning ki, the duty of the husband is to provide shelter, food, clothing, and everything. Okay, these
yeah.
can be provided. We, if we have money
yeah.
or we don't have money, these
yeah.
things can be provided.
Yeah.
But still, the situation is not happy. These things can be provided very easily, you know, food, shelter.
Guidance is there. Emotional support.
Yes, that's what I'm asking, because that is also important.
Mm-hmm.
If that thing is not there, we are only giving food, shelter, and clothing, and other things like home. Then, and if we are not giving emotional support, then that thing will not work also. This thing also is included in the prescribed duty.
Well, let's see. Let's see some examples of how the relationship of husband and wife is from the relationship between Kardama Muni and Devahuti. All right? After the departure of her parents, the chaste woman, Devahuti, who could understand the desires of her husband, served him constantly with great love, as Bhavani, the wife of Shiva, serves her husband. O Vidura, Devahuti served her husband with intimacy and great respect, with control of the senses, with love and with sweet words. Purport. Here, two words are very significant. Devahuti served her husband in two ways, Vishrambhena and Gauravhena. These are two important processes in serving the husband or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vishrambhena means with intimacy, and Gauravhena means with great reverence. The husband is a very intimate friend, therefore the wife must render service just like an intimate friend. At the same time, she must understand that the husband is superior in position, and thus she must offer him all respect. A man's psychology and woman's psychology are different. As constituted by bodily frame, a man always wants to be superior to his wife, and a woman, as bodily constituted, is naturally inferior to her husband. Thus, the natural instinct is that the husband wants to post himself as superior to the wife, and this must be observed. Even if there is some wrong on the part of the husband, the wife must tolerate it. And thus, there will be no misunderstanding between husband and wife. Vishrambhena means with intimacy. But it must not be familiarity that breeds contempt. According to the Vedic civilization, a woman cannot call her husband by name. In the present civilization, the wife calls her husband by name, but in Hindu civilization, she does not. Thus, the inferiority and superiority complexes are recognized. Dhamenacha. A wife has to learn to control herself even if there is a misunderstanding. Sohrudena vacha madhuraya means always desiring good for the husband and speaking to him with sweet words. A person becomes agitated by so many material contacts in the outside world. Therefore, in his home life, he must be treated by the wife with sweet words. So that gives an example of how things should run. So there's a few things to note here, that when describing Sri Dharma in the 7th canto, 11th chapter, verses 25 to 29, Srila Prabhupada quotes Madhvacharya, where he says that the wife should see the husband to be God. And why is that? That to be able to get into the spiritual world, one has to develop what? What is the attitude you have to develop to get it?
Huh?
We have to develop a service attitude, serving attitude. So by the karma that that woman has, Krishna has sent her this husband to practice on. Because Krishna chose that husband because he knows that this is what she needs. That he will, that any anarthas that she might have will be demonstrated to her by having to serve this husband. Because how else did you get that husband? How else did you get that husband? Unless it's by your karma, right? So we have to, because we're not, no one, not with this, no one will get into the spiritual world unless one develops the proper attitude. Krishna doesn't want barbarians in the spiritual world. It will ruin the whole mood. Everybody is so, deals with each other so nicely. So much nice, loving exchanges are there. You're not going to let some party crasher in. We have to learn how to deal nicely with each other. So, and under, even under stressful situations, it has to be, which is not going to be easy, but we have to learn how to do it. And so in the Grihastha Ashram, we have to live closely with each other, and sometimes there's some stress is there. Now, of course, before getting the two people married, there's the whole idea of, you know, of seeking, you know, not love marriages, but in arranged marriages, like, you know, that you make sure that they're going to be compatible. That's the whole idea of us using astrology, having the parents are involved, you know, because we're speaking about the whole reason you brought this point up was because there's coldness, some lack of emotion, and lack of emotional response between the spouse. Well, that could have been seen ahead of time, before the, like, I just unfortunately got some news of a case. I won't mention any names. In 1998, their guru asked me to do a preliminary reading on their horoscopes to see, you know, if it's yes or no, and then to do a more in-depth reading later. So I took and I never do this again because of what happened. I'll never do this again because of what happened. I took a preliminary look and said, it looked okay. So they said, okay, do a more in-depth reading. So I went to the all in-depth reading and I said, oh, this is not going to work. So I told him, it's not going to work. He said, we got married last week. And I was like, I was shocked. Weren't you going to just wait until I give my final decision? So they got married without, you know. So I just heard a couple of weeks ago that now he's leaving his wife for another woman because he feels like she's like his mother. He doesn't want to be married to his mother, you know, anyway. So, so the point being is you try to, because, you know, married, material life is difficult. And having two material lives together makes it more difficult. So you want to get it so the people are going to be able to live with each other. You know, so it's easier to perform your prescribed duties if you get along. Why make it more difficult? You know, why is it that every day has to, I'm doing this to please Krishna, I hate the person, but I'm, you know, you know, gritting your teeth all the time. You know, it should be that there's a love and affection. It's like in the case of Draupadi, of Devahuti. She chose the husband. She heard about this person, his good qualities, she chose. That's why most of the eight forms of marriage, the ones which are recognized as being good, are always ones where it's the husband who's chosen by the girl's side. Or even like in these Kshatriya marriages, the Swayamvara, like in the case of Draupadi, she chose who she wanted to marry. Because once the girl chooses, that's who she fixes her mind on. You know, and if anything goes wrong later, she has nobody to blame. You know, of course, the parents are there, the father's there to make sure nothing goes wrong. Because her father's the one who arranged the Swayamvara, or the case of the different wives of Krishna, the different Swayamvaras were arranged by the fathers. But then the Kshatriya girl, she chose who she wanted to marry. So then her mind is already fixed because that's her psychology. So she was willing to do all that was necessary. She adapts, the wife adapts to the husband. she was a princess. Sort of, or it's like when Agastya married Lopamudra, she was a princess. So she agreed to marry him. The father and mother didn't want to think, ah, my God, Agastya Muni's like this tall. Doesn't look very good. But the thing is, Agastya Muni created Lopamudra. He was, the story was, his Pitri Devatas wanted him to have a child because they were going to go to hell unless he had his child. So he agreed, and he couldn't figure out who he should marry because there was nobody who was good enough. So he created Lopamudra, and he put her, implanted her in the semen of her father. Then when he came to marry, the father didn't want to give because he's not very attractive looking. And, but he was a diplomat, so he said, well, let my wife decide. He didn't, because otherwise the king, he'll get cursed by the rishi. So then he passed the baton to the wife, and the wife, before the wife could say anything, Lopamudra agreed, I'll marry him, because she was made to marry him. So what did Agastya Rishi, the first thing he told her? Take off those beautiful clothes and put these rags on. Put these rags on, because that's his lifestyle. His lifestyle is like that. So one of the, so, for that, that's the way he lives. So she had to adapt to that. So that's also seen in the, that's part of Stri Dharma, is that the wife has to follow the vows of the husband. She has to be prepared to follow his vows. If she doesn't follow his vows, then it's going to create problems. That's why they should be of the same guna. A woman who's dominated by sattva guna, she should marry a brahmana, because brahmins are dominated by sattva guna. A woman who's dominated by rajaguna should marry a man who's dominated by rajaguna. No, so, but they can marry. Sometimes they can marry a man who's a sattvic, like in the case of Devahuti. She came from a kshatriya. Her father was Swayambhuva Manu, Devahuti. But she married a brahmin. That can happen, you know. She had followed his vows. So it says here, Prabhupada translate the words pati devanam. Strinam cha pati devanam. So he translates the word pati devanam, those women who have accepted their husbands as worshipable. He translates that as the word chaste. So the word chaste, when you read it in Prabhupada's books, means a lot more than what it appears to be. So it says, verse 25, the beginning of Stri Dharma, to render service to the husband, to be always favorably disposed toward the husband, to be equally well disposed toward the husband's relatives and friends. That means the mother-in-law, the famous mother-in-law. Like, Draupadi had no problems with Kunti.
Still. But right now,
that's all right.
Today's circumstances.
Right. Okay. Well, let's just see. Let's put it this way. The way Draupadi dealt with Kunti was Draupadi. The way she dealt, it's like when Draupadi found out that Arjuna had married Subhadra, she was furious. She was furious. She was enraged. So what did Arjuna do? He had Subhadra dressed up as a cowherd girl and made as the servant of Draupadi. And she was very humble and broke Draupadi's heart. She couldn't do anything because Subhadra was so humble. So then she blessed, may your husband live long. But she was originally very angry. But because Subhadra was so humble, it broke Draupadi's heart. And Draupadi put all her sons in the care of Subhadra when they went to the forest, because of how Subhadra dealt with her, won the heart of Draupadi, who was enraged. She was like, she was very upset, to be very, very upset. But she was won over by the humility of Subhadra. So that will have, not so much that, so that was the qualification of Subhadra, of her humility. That was same the case. The same as in the case of we read about Sukanya and Chaiwana Rishi in the 8th canto. She was very young, and because she blinded Chaiwana Rishi by poking one of his eyes out when he was in meditation, she ended up marrying, you know, because of doing that, the whole kingdom became in trouble. But then her father married Sukanya to Chaiwana Rishi, who was an old man, very irritable. These rishis, when you read these rishis, they are very quick to anger and very quick to bless. But both sides are there. They very easily anger, very irritable, because they're doing all these heavy tapasya, you know. So, but she was able to please her husband, Sukanya, very, very, you know, even though he was irritable, even though he was cranky, she was just very, very able to please him. And he gave her all blessings. That was the whole thing of Durvasa Muni and Kunti. In fact, Durvasa Muni was very, he would purposely aggravate people. He is not just by his nature, he did it on purpose. He would come in at all times of the night and expect food to be there. He'd come at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, whatever, hours of the night, maybe he might not be there for 2 days, and all of a sudden show up and he expected all food to be there. And Draupadi had everything ready. I mean, Kunti had everything ready. She was very, and he did this for not for one or two nights, not for, he did it for like a year, for several, for a long time, purposely seeing how he could get the person agitated. He was doing it on purpose, but they never got agitated. So then he knew what would happen to Pandu, because he's a Trikalagya. He gave her that blessing that you can call any deva, because she's going to need it. He knew that would be happening to her in the future, to her husband. But he purposely would aggravate. But she, by her humility and by her good character, she was able to pacify somebody like Durvasa Muni, you know, and who actually was doing it on purpose. Chaiwana Rishi wasn't doing it on purpose. That's just the way he was. Still, Sukanya was able to pacify him. And so the whole mood of the house, the husband may provide, getting back to your question, the husband provide the shelter, the food, to his capacity. That's his duty. The tapasya of the wife is she has to accept whatever the husband can provide. He may not be like the Pandavas, who can provide the, you know, Indraprastha. He may not be able to provide so much. Of course, Draupadi accepted the Pandavas when they were poor, not when they were rich. So that was one point. Karna, they were trying to figure out how to separate Draupadi from the Pandavas, and Karna said, "You're foolish. She accepted them when they were poor. How are you going to separate her from them when they're rich?" So, but that's the austerity of the lady, that they have to accept whatever the husband can provide. You know, as Chanakya Pandit said, a friend is tested in time of adversity, and the wife is tested in time of poverty. That's when the test comes from the wife. So, whatever the case may be, the husband provides to the best of his ability. But then it's the wife who creates the mood in the house. The husband provides, you know, the home, but then it's the wife who provides the mood in the house. She's the one who makes it happy or not. If the wife is happy, then the house is happy. If the wife is not happy, then the house is not happy. That's what she does. She sets the mood inside the house. The husband may provide all the materials, but it's up to her to create. And how is that? We see here. So getting back to this, well-disposed towards the husband's relatives and friends. It's not that she only likes the husband, but doesn't like his brother. You know, he doesn't like his sisters. You know, let's speak of the mother-in-law. I had one case like that where the boy was so upset because his wife was, you know, cursing his brothers and sisters, and he had been a happy family. Then now his wife doesn't want any of his family to come. And here's the important part: to follow the vows of the husband. These are the four principles followed by women described as chaste: the vows of the husband. So, we sometimes hear, you know, a Brahmin woman or a Kshatriya woman. There's no such thing as a Kshatriya woman or a Brahmin woman, because women don't have varna. women are in a class by themselves. You know, women don't go out and fight, you know. That's the Varna implies, Varna requires two things. Chaturvarna, Maya Srishtam, Guna and Karma. So all women have guna. Everything has got guna, including women have guna.
But one point can be raised in this case.
Yeah.
Like if somebody following Krishna consciousness,
okay,
or Vishnu vision, then he is above all the varnas. Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Sutra. Then somebody can say.
Somebody can say that, but let's say your whole point, and then I'll get. Okay.
Somebody can say because we are following Krishna consciousness, or we don't have to follow any duty because we are above all these ashram duties.
Somebody could say that. All right. My spiritual master had one godbrother. His name was Krishnadas. His name was Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji. When he joined the Gaudiya Mutt, everybody complained about him because all he wanted to do was just chant Hare Krishna. He didn't want to peel potatoes in the kitchen. He didn't want to clean the Brahmachari ashram. He didn't want to do anything. He just wanted to chant Hare Krishna all the time. So the temple commander complained to the temple president complained, so they wrote letters to Bhaktisiddhanta. This man, what should we do with him? He doesn't want to do anything. He doesn't want to do anything, no service. All he wants to do is chant Hare Krishna. So Bhaktisiddhanta wrote back and says, we want more men like this. He's a devotee. He's a really, you know, we should put an advertisement, all Gaudiya Mutt, he gave an instruction, all Gaudiya Mutts, to put an advertisement in local newspaper that we will give free room and board to anyone who can chant Hare Krishna 24 hours a day. So they did that. And a few people applied for the positions, but they could only last 2 or 3 weeks. Then they realized that Mr. Akinchana Das Babaji was different. He actually could do it 24 hours a day. So now, what the 9 processes of Bhagavad Dharma are: Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam. So if a person can perform all of these 24 hours a day, then indeed they are beyond Van Ashram duties. But then, still, they should do them. For one thing is, first they should do them, because even Krishna explains in the 3rd chapter of Bhagavad Gita, I don't have to do any duties, but I do them anyway. He's not subjected to karma. Krishna does the duties anyway, because he's setting an example. He sets an example so that other people can follow these duties. Well, that's one point. So even if somebody is on the elevated, even if they are Mahabhagavats, they still perform duties for other people to follow. Otherwise, people will do, oh, he did this, I can do this, you know. So that's one point. Second point is, I don't know very many people like that who are on that level. They're very rare. So what is that person going to do after they stop chanting the rounds? If they're not, as soon as you stop engaging in that, then you have to engage with the material energy. That means you have to engage in Varna Ashram. That's the only way you can engage in with your material energy. That person, they're just living under a tree? Are they just living under a tree? No. They have to get, how do they get that house? They have to get a job. So that means they're doing some type of duty. So if you're going to do a duty, then we should do it the way Krishna says we should do it, because he knows about these things. And he's the one who created the whole world. He explains how to perform all these different things. So, there's a very nice verse in the 11th canto in this regard. So this is Maharaj Nimi speaking to the Navi Yogendras. This is chapter 11, no, canto 11, chapter 3, verse 41. Maharaj Nimi said, "O great sages, please speak to us about the process of karma yoga. Purified by this process of dedicating one's practical work to the Supreme, a person can very quickly free himself from all material activities, even in this life, and thus enjoy pure life on the transcendental platform." So that's what, that's the vast, vast majority of us have to deal with that. The whole Bhagavad Gita is Krishna explaining to Arjuna. Now who do you know that's more elevated than Arjuna? It doesn't have to, even Arjuna has to do these things. So these Mahabhagavats are very, and even they, even they're performing these activities to set an example that we don't have to. Of course, Lord Chaitanya said, you know, "I'm not a Brahmin, I'm not this, I'm not that." But still, he performed his sannyas duties very rigidly, didn't he? He was the most rigid performer of his duties. He didn't slack off. In fact, Bhakti said, why did Bhakti Siddhanta, Prabhupada explained, I just was reading how Prabhupada, but how Bhakti Siddhanta wanted to establish Daivi Varna Ashram. Well, one of the reasons, why did he want to, he's the one who reinstituted sannyas into Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Everybody was taking, they were becoming Babaji's, which is like Paramahamsa stage, immediately going to Paramahamsa stage. So you introduced, you know, Brahmacharis, all these different sannyas, ashram, Tridanda sannyas. He went to South India, studied all these things, we introduced them. Why? Because at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhakti Siddhanta, that to be called a Gaudiya Vaishnava meant that you were a debauchee. It was a debauchee's religion. That's why, like, the Vivekananda mission, all that, that the Ramakrishna mission became very prominent, because at that time Vaishnavism was considered extremely low class because of so much mixing between, you know, all the apasampradayas and the person, you know, very loose mixing, sahajas, very loose mixing of the sexes. Well, we don't have to follow these things. We have to follow these rules and regulations. We're above all these things. Right? We're above all these things. And that it became, everything became very degraded because of this. Srila Prabhupada explained in one, how the reason he didn't appreciate sadhus, because, you know, if you know Prabhupada's history, how his father would always invite sadhus for dinner. There's always some sadhu came, and they always ask the sadhus, "Please bless my son. He'll become a devotee of Radharani." Right? You know that, right? So Prabhupada explained one time why he, you know, and it was when they asked him to come and see Bhaktivedanta, said, "Ah, I've seen enough of these sadhus." You know. But what was it? Is that these sadhus that that his father was bringing, they were all very bogus. Like his, he would sometimes accompany his father to deliver like a kg of ganja to some of these sadhus were just smoking charash and ganja and opium, and his father would be bringing it to them. So it says, from Bhakti Siddhanta we learned purity, no intoxication. What does, you know, what to speak of ganja, no tea, no coffee, no cigarettes. So Bhakti Siddhanta, you know, this purity. So no mixing of the sexes, no of this, you know. We're the one of the biggest problems in ISKCON is that devotees have a tendency to think that they're a lot more advanced than they really are. A lot more. And then that creates a major problem. They think they don't have to follow the rules and regulations, and the next thing you know, there's a scandal. If you read in the Veda base, the February 14th, 1977 Varnashram conversation, there's three conversations on that day. The Varnashram conversation. So February 14th, Valentine's Day, 1977. It's a discussion between Srila Prabhupada, Hari Sori, and Satsarup Maharaj about how Prabhupada wanted that Varnashram. I'll get it right now. But Prabhupada wanted that Varnashram be instituted in ISKCON. Okay, this is the conversation. Room conversation, Varnashram system must be introduced. February 14th, 1977. Satsarup thought they were suppressed, Prabhupada. Revolution means they are dissatisfied. Satsarup, French Revolution, Russian Revolution, Prabhupada. These things were not going nicely. Let me see if I can get to the point where they're talking about Varnashram. Okay, so then Satsarup says, Varnashram is not required. Prabhupada said, not required. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu denied, I am not Brahmana, I am not Kshatriya, I am not this, I am not this. He rejected. But in the Bhagavad Gita, the Chatur Varna Maya Srishtam, so we are Krishna, preaching Krishna consciousness. It must be done. Harishauri. But in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's practical preaching, he only induced them to chant. Prabhupada, that is not possible for ordinary man. Harishori, what? To simply induce people to chant? Prabhupada, Harishori, he only induced just the chanting. Prabhupada, but who will chant? Who will chant? Satsarup, but if they won't chant, then neither will they train up in Varnashram. That's the easiest. Prabhupada, the chanting will be there, but you cannot expect that people will chant like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They cannot even chant 16 rounds. And these rascals are going to be Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? He's talking about his own disciples, by the way. These rascals. Satsvarup. No, but if they at least will chant and take some prasad, Prabhupada, chanting will go on. That is not stopped. But at the same time, the Varnashram Dharma must be established to make the way easy. Harishauri. Well, at least my own understanding was that the chanting was introduced in the age of Kali because Varnashram is not possible. Prabhupada, because it will cleanse the mind, chanting will not stop. Harishauri. So therefore the chanting was introduced to replace all of the systems of Varnashram and like that? Prabhupada, yes, it can replace, but who is going to replace it? The people are not so advanced. If you imitate Haridas Thakur to chant, it is not possible. Satsvarup, we tell them, go on and your job, but chant also. Prabhupada, yes. He quotes Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recommended stane stita. And if they do not remain in the stana, then the sahajyas chanting will come. Just like the sahajyas also have not the beads and they have got 36 women. This kind of chanting will go on. Just like our quote, name withheld. There's one sannyasi, godbrother. He was not fit for sannyas, but he was given sannyas, and 5 women he was attached, and he disclosed. Therefore, Varnashram Dharma is required. Simply show bottle will not do. So the Varnashram Dharma should be introduced all over the world, and Satsvarup, introduced starting with ISKCON community? Prabhupada, yes, yes, Brahmana, Kshatriyas. There must be regular education. Harishori, but in our community, if the beings, as we're training up as Vaishnavas, Prabhupada, yes, then how will we be able to make divisions in our society? Prabhupada, Vaishnava is not so easy. The Varnashram Dharma should be established to become a Vaishnava. It is not so easy to become Vaishnava. Harishori, no, it's not a cheap thing. That when I arrived in Mayapur just after this conversation, and for several days, Satsarup was giving, on the bank of the Gangas, talks about this. So Prabhupada was saying, Vaishnava is not a cheap thing. That's why I said the problem in ISKCON is we think we're a lot more advanced than we really are. When we read in Prabhupada's books, where Prabhupada talks about devotees, he means, like, the Bodhi means like Kunti Devi. It means like Dhruva Maharaj. Like, you know, Dhruva Maharaj, Arjuna, this means devotee. Garuda, Hanuman, these are devotees. Not me. Not this sannyas name withheld who fell down. Because what does Krishna explain? My devotee, he never falls down in any circumstance. And so to be a devotee is not a cheap thing. Yes, therefore it should be made. Vaishnava, to become Vaishnava is not so easy. If Vaishnava, to become Vaishnava is so easy, why so many fall down? Fall down. It is not easy. The sannyas is for the highest qualified brahmana. And simply by dressing like a Vaishnava, that is, fall down. In fact, in one other conversation, Prabhupada describes that to come to the highest brahminical platform means, that means neophyte devotee. We have a long ways to go. Harishari. So the Varnashram system is like for the Kanishtas, Kanishta Adhikari. Prabhupada Kanishta. I think this is where he's saying it right here. Prabhupada Kanishta, Harishari. Well, when one is only on the platform of neophyte, Prabhupada, yes, yes, Kanishta Adhikari, yes. Harishauri, Varnashram system is beneficial. Prabhupada, Kanishta Adhikari means he must be a brahmana. That is Kanishta Adhikari. It means highest brahminical platform, that's Kanishta Adhikari. So who's, do you know, that's on such an elevated platform? Who's very brahminical? That's Kanishta Adhikari. So we have a long ways to go. Just to become a Kanishta. I can only speak for myself. I have a long ways to go just to become Kanishta Adhikari. You know, very elevated brahminical principles. A spiritual life, Kanishta Adhikari, means he must be a qualified brahmana. That is Kanishta. What is esteemed as very high position in the material world, brahmana, that is Kanishta Adhikari. The brahmana means from the material stage, gradually he is elevated to the spiritual stage. And below the brahmana, there is no question of Vaishnava. So, Harishari, no question of proper Vaishnavism. By becoming a brahmana, hearing, or by hearing, he becomes a brahmana, the other qualities, shudra qualities, kshatriya, vaishya, means finished. So then next stage is Srinvatam sva katha krishna punya shravana kirtana hridyantya nasta prayeshu abhadreshu. By this process, getting back to your question, Mataji, by this process, hearing, without becoming a brahmana, nobody is interested to hear. Then by hearing, nasta prayeshu abhadreshu, then abhadra means the base quality, means ignorance and passion. These are the base qualities. So nasta prayeshu abhadreshu, then these base qualities are finished, almost, not complete. Nityam bhagavata sevaya. By hearing from bhagavata, what's not complete is that the parabdha karma is not destroyed. Everything else is destroyed, but Prabhupada comes not this. That's why it says almost complete. When these base qualities are finished, almost not complete, by hearing from Bhagavata or by serving the spiritual master in Krishna consciousness movement, then he becomes fixed up in devotional. This devotional service is the first great quality of sattva gun. Anyway, continues on that conversation. So it's, that's why the importance, you know, somebody says, oh, you don't have to, you know, it's not so cheap. That person, they don't have to follow that. That means that they're, anybody who says like that is a cheater. They say they don't have to follow. They have to follow. When Ramanujacharya, he wanted to take initiation from, what's his name? No, not Yadava Prakash. It was Kanchipurna. Kanchipurna was he was just born in a Shudra family. He was but highly elevated. Varadaraj would personally speak to him. He would be seen walking down the streets of Kanchi having a conversation with somebody who nobody else could see. And people would give questions to him to ask Varada Dev, and then they would get the responses back. In fact, they wouldn't even give him the question. They just say, I have some questions. And then Varadeva would give him the answers to their questions, like that. So Ramanuja wanted to take initiation from him. He says, I can't give you initiation. Even though he was highly elevated, he says, I'm born in a Shudra family. Krishna has created the Varnashram system. It's not my position to make any disruption in that. If I was to initiate you, that would create a disruption in the system that Krishna has created, so I won't do it, even though he was qualified to do it. So then Ramanuja tried so many different tricks to become his disciple, that he evaded all of the tricks, because he didn't like that. Yes, Mataji?
Like we take Harina initiation, and then we take Brahmanical initiation.
Mm-hmm.
As we read the Brahman qualities, it's really high.
Okay, let me just say one thing, is that actually it's somehow or other it's become called Brahminical initiation, but actually it's just second initiation. Because what happened, Brahminical initiation is Vaidic Diksha, which is offered to men only, but Vaishnava Diksha is called Pancha Samskara, available to anyone. Male, female, human, non-human, because it's not on the material platform. Brahminical is part Brahman, is part of Varna Ashram, which is on totally on the material platform, psychophysical platform. It's based upon gunas, it's, you know, the whole thing. It's all on the material platform. So, in other sampradayas, say the pancha samskaras are Dasyanam, Urdhvapundra, Tapan, Yagya, and Mantra. So, actually, someone who is not initiated should not wear tilak. That's Urdhvapundra. Someone who is not initiated should not wear neck beads. But in ISKCON, Gaudiya Math, they said, you're slack on that. So, in other sampradayas, the five pancha samskaras are given all at once. Because there's, you know, usually there's a more intimate relationship with the devotee and the guru. But Bhakti Siddhanta, because he was touring so much, he divided the Pancha Samskara into two portions. So in the first initiation, as we see in ISKCON, there's three of the Pancha Samskaras are given. Dasyanam, Urdhvapundra, and Tapan. So Tapan in other sampradayas is called Shankha Chakra Mudra Dharana. They brand you with hot iron of Shankha and Chakra. You know, depending upon which sampradaya, they hold it, they may hold it on like that, or they may hold it on like that. With the Madhva sampradaya, every 6 months you get in it, but in Sri Vaishnavas, only once is required for the rest of the life, because they hold it on for a long time. Because why do they brand you? Is because, you know, I don't know, but in India, do they brand cattle in India? Yeah. They chose who's the owner of this cow, right? So branding with the mark of Vishnu means you belong to this. We know who the owner of this body is. So in Gaudiya Sampradaya, we don't use that. We use this. It's like you see this a dog in the street with a collar. It means it has an owner. No collar is a stray dog. So we have an owner. This means that. That's why at the initiation ceremony, you always see neck beads are there. Even if somebody has neck beads, which are the only uninitiated devotees, they say just one strand, right? They shouldn't be wearing any, but they do not. Then Urdhvapundra. Uninitiated devotees shouldn't wear, but we do. Somehow it's become a tradition in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. But other sampradayas, only after initiation they were Urdhvapundra. And Dasyanam, you're named after you get a Hari Das, you know, that's what we now call Harinam initiation. But that Dasyanam, actually Dasa does not mean servant, it means slave. I heard one nice lecture given by one Sri Sannyasi. He was quoting the Ramayana, where Hanuman explained that I'm not the servant of Ram. A servant, after his time is finished, he can do whatever he wants to do. Like I have an attendant, after 8 o'clock, he's free. Until next morning, 8 o'clock. But he says, I'm not a servant of Ram, I'm the slave of Ram. I have no independence. I'm totally dependent on Lord Ram. And then mantra are the mantras which the guru gives for the sampradaya mantras. Anybody here who is second initiated knows what they are. Those would be mantras 2 to 7. Those are the sampradaya mantras. The guru bij, guru gayatri, gaur bij, gaur gayatri, kama bij, kama gayatri. Those are required for yaga. Yaga is the specific service of deity worship. So those five constitute pancha samskara. So in the second initiation, Bhaktisiddhanta would give the mantra and yaga, deity worship, and the mantra is required. And then after that, because now a person is born, reborn, by getting initiation, they're reborn. Then, for men, he would give Brahma Gayatri and Upanayanam. For men only. Because the, as I said earlier, Upanayana was given at a young age. So, Upanayana, sacred thread. Sacred thread.
Yaga
means deity, basically deity worship. Vaishnavas, all Vaishnavas are meant to worship the deities, Shalagram, Shila, or you know, some murti at home. So you have to have these mantras, which we have, are required. The deity, you can't, you know, you have to know these mantras, Guru Bija, Guru Gayatri, to order to perform the deity worship. You need these, you know, these are our sampradaya mantras. Can't do it without that. So as I said earlier, Upanayana was given to, you know, Brahmin, Kshatriyas, and Vaishya boys at a certain age. Manu says if this initiation, Upanayana, is not given by us, there's a time limit. If that time limit is passed, then they cannot get they cannot get Upanayana. They are just considered, you know, just outcast, they're Panchamas. They're not even in Varnashram anymore. Shudras. So, because, you know, we're getting. You know, now that we're getting pancha samskar, you know, at way past the age of Upanayana, but now that we've gotten pancha samskar, then Bhakti Siddhanta, because now we're born again, then you can get for men Upanayana. He would give Upanayana to men because he was trying to prove the point that Vaishnavas were equivalent or above Brahmins. He wrote a whole book, the Brahmin and Vaishnava debate. At that time, there was these caste Brahmins who were, you know, creating problems. You know, so he would do it like that, and he would give the Upanayana and give the Savitri Gayatri. But Prabhupada never gave women like that. There was a whole thing like that. So therefore, it's a misnomer to say Brahminical initiation, because women can't be Brahmins. It's because it's a material designation. You can be a Brahmini. You can be the wife of a Brahmin. Because the duty of the wife is to follow the vow of her husband. So if her husband's a Brahmin, she becomes a Brahmini. She's a Brahmin because her husband's a Brahmin, because she's following the vows of her husband. Because when she was living in the ashram of her father, then she would follow the vows of her father. Her mother was following the vows of her father. She's following the vows of her father. So like the case of Devahuti, her father was a Kshatriya. So she was following Kshatriya vows. Then she married Kardama Muni, who is the Brahmin. So then she was following his vows. Because she was able to successfully do it, she became a Brahmini. That's why there should be some closeness between, you know, it'd be much, that's why it's not good if the wife, if the woman is born in the family and her father's a Brahmin, and to marry somebody like in the case of Yayati and Sharmishta, that created the problem, which Yayati regretted. he didn't want to marry her. Because he knew a problem is ahead. Problems are ahead if I marry a Brahmin girl. Because her vows that she was following were higher than his vows. So then she would have to lower herself to follow his vows. Whereas in case of Draupadi, she had went the opposite. I mean, Devahuti went the other way. Anyway, so getting to your point about, you were mentioning something about second initiation. But you forgot what you were. Go ahead.
We take this initiation, but when we read the qualities of Brahman,
that's
too high. It's too high.
And that's Kanishta Adhikari, Prabhupada just explained.
Yeah.
Prabhupada, that's a Kanishta Adhikari, and we're saying it's too high.
But we still go ahead and take this initiation.
So initiation means beginning. Beginning. Doesn't mean conclusion. So, there's a sloka. Janma jayate sudra samskarat babet dvija. Starting the Veda, one becomes if and but. Brahmaniti iti janiti brahmana. Everyone is born a sudra. But by samskara, one becomes a dvija. By study of the Veda, one becomes a vipra. And when one knows Brahman, one is a Brahmana. So at initiation, sir, at the time of initiation, what does the word initiation mean? To initiate, to begin, not to conclude. Do you understand? So we're not expecting at the beginning you should have the results of the conclusion. You're beginning. You have to start somewhere. So it's not surprising that somebody who at the beginning is like somebody goes to medical school and the first day they're not going to be doctors. At the conclusion, when you graduate, then you're a physician. So you're initiating into medicine on the first day when you enter the medical school. But at the end of the process, you should be a qualified doctor. You should have, people shouldn't be fearful if they see you with a scalpel in your hand. You know? You're qualified to operate on somebody. But when you go in at the beginning, you're not. That's initiation. So initiated as, in second initiation, we're beginning the process. That's literally what the word initiation means. To start, not to end. At the end is what we should have those qualities. At some at some point, those qualities should begin to manifest. Not at the, it'd be very rare. And even if at the beginning, I mean, they should, it's continuous, you know. I heard Srila Prabhupada once explain that the main occupation of a brahmana is to improve his character. Continuous improvement of the character. Not that it stays static. Just like Srila Prabhupada is a great personality, but he always considers himself less than Bhakti Siddhanta. And no matter how great Srila Prabhupada became, is, he'll always be less than Bhakti Siddhanta because Bhakti Siddhanta didn't stop. Bhakti Siddhanta is always becoming greater. Because that's the nature of spiritual life. It's always expanding. It's not static. One time my brother tried to trick me. He presented a paradox to me. Can God create a stone so heavy that he can't lift it? Can God do that? I'm asking you. I'm asking her. Can God create a stone so heavy that God can't lift it? Well, then he's not, how can he be God then? That means he's put a limitation. So that's a paradoxical statement. But if we understand what the meaning of Brahman means, Brahma is always expanding. So at the moment he created it, it was too heavy to lift. But the next instant, he became more powerful, so he could lift it. And we always read how Krishna's qualities are infinite, that even Lord Anantadev, with infinite number of mouths, speaking for infinity, for infinite time, could not, you know, even Krishna is not even aware of his own qualities, because he's so great. So yes, so he can create a stone that's so heavy that he can't lift it, because then he can lift it. All these opposites are contained in Krishna.
what is the most important duty of the grihastha?
Grihastas on which side? The male side or the female side?
Both.
Well, is to serve Krishna, because that way you just have to serve Krishna.
Because in one asset in Vaishnava, people don't talk about it, doesn't know that in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying the most important duty of Grihastha is to serve guest, prescribed duty of Grihastha, to serve guest who is coming. Or serve the Vaishnavas.
That would be true also. When we serve Krishna, why would somebody like, you know? Now, Jarasandha also served guests, but so what's the difference between his serving of guests and Duryodhana also wanted to serve guests, great servant of guests. So Krishna, he arrived, and Duryodhana asked, "Can you please come to my house to eat dinner?" And Krishna said, "No, I don't want to," because he offered to serve the guests. You know, to serve. And so then, Duryodhana, he's saying this in front of thousands of kings. And Krishna, so he said, "Well, why?" He says, "Well, you know, a person only eats if they're in distress, that means if they're hungry, or if the food is offered with love." He says, "I'm not hungry, and you don't love me. Therefore, I'm not going to eat with you. I'm going to go eat at Vidura's house." So he was doing, you know, so it's obvious in Varnashram you serve guests. It's like Yudhishthir was a very good example. He only ate Vigasha. You know what Vigasha is? Yudhishthira only ate Vigasha, which is the food left over after the guests have eaten. He only would eat that. He and Draupadi would eat the last, whatever was left. You know, that's what he would eat. He would not take, he'd eat the remnants. He said, that's better than any, that's the best that is available, food that's there. But yeah, so, of all the duties, but is he, then we're supposed to be doing Daivi Varnashram. In Varnashram, we, of course, you serve guests, but like I said, so many asuras who have followed Varnashram also did that. But the main part is, you know, we should be, if we have Krishna at the center, then our whole Grihastha Ashram has a different viewpoint. You know, that the, as Prabhupada explained in the verse, I think it's 1848 of the Gita, that one should see that Krishna is our employer. That's Daivi Varnashram. Krishna is our employer, and therefore we do all our duties based upon that. He's our master. So even our Grihastha duties, we're doing it to please him. Because we have to remember we're Vaishnavas. So even our Varnashram duties have to be Krishna-centered. That's why Daivi Varnashram. We're doing it to please Krishna. So we serve guests to please Krishna. We take care of our wife to please Krishna. The mother takes care of her children, even though the child is very dirty. Even though the child doesn't want to eat the five things you just told her, the kid, to eat. You know, you're doing it to please Krishna. It tries your patience. You know, you're doing it to please Krishna. Yeah. Yeah. Well, both have to be done. The example, if you know, it doesn't look very good, like in the case I just was mentioning about this man who's going to leave his wife for another woman. He's a very, if I mention his name, you will all know him. Done a lot of preaching, very prominent, But all that preaching will be, you know, have some nullification if he leaves his wife. It would be negative preaching, right? We also have to live. You know, that was the whole thing about Haridas Thakur. That was described about Haridas Thakur, that many people have very good achar, but not very good prachar, and others are very good with the prachar, but not very good with their achar. But the unique thing about Haridas Thakur, he had excellent achar and excellent prachar. That example is the highest precept. People see by how you live. So what's going to be the good if your house is dirty, your husband hasn't been fed, your kids are not fed, and you're preaching? What are you preaching? There's the book Bhagavatam and the person Bhagavatam. Right? So we should also emulate, when they say the person Bhagavatam, and you should be living the qualities which are seen in the Bhagavatam. So how did Draupadi deal with her husbands? How did Kunti deal? You know, like that would be, if you want to live that life, then we have to emulate the persons who we see in the Bhagavatam. That would be good. That would be a lot better preaching, don't you think? And people see, oh, this person is actually sincere. They actually do. They're not just talking. We preach, but then we can't follow up. There'll be some lack there. People think it's a hypocrisy. So they say one thing, but they do another thing. There should be preaching. We have to, because that's also preaching. We see that was what was so impressed so many devotees about Srila Prabhupada. He the way he lived, not just what he said, but the way he lived, very courageously, all the things that he did. Like one of my godbrothers, he met Srila Prabhupada, and Srila Prabhupada, it was during a Guru Puja. They were doing Guru Puja to Srila Prabhupada, singing Sri Guru Charanapadmi, like that. And he was noticing that Srila Prabhupada was also singing. Prabhupada also was singing. And he said, this is very strange. He's also singing the same. The disciples are singing him, and he's also singing the same song. What is this, you know? So they asked the devotee, well, why is he singing the same? You know, he's also glorifying himself. He said, no. Well, we're doing puja to him. He's doing puja to his guru. Then he immediately joined the pack, because he's also doing the same thing. We have to live by what we say. So if we preach, and then when we're preaching, people read in the books, but then we're not doing what it says in the books, then how is that preaching? You know, we preach one thing, but then we're not doing what we're saying, you know. And of course, the problem is that sometimes devotees are selling books, but they're not reading them. That becomes also a problem. We have to read, otherwise they just become like a society of booksellers who don't read their own books. Then they'll create problems. We have to read. We have to read. Then we'll inculcate those qualities. So it's important to preach, but also our preaching will be more from example. It's like if you have children, your children are not going to listen to what you say. They're going to listen to what you do. I don't listen to what people say, I listen to what they do. They may say so many things. What they do that counts. That's the most important thing, is what they do. So if you're wondering why your children, the children pick up the values of the parents. The parents' values will be what they do. What they do, what they think is important is what they'll do. And that's what the children will do. Because they see this is what's important. So I think it's both are important. You have to be able to preach, but also the preaching, it also has to be reflected. Because by doing it to please Krishna, how does killing people on the battlefield help Arjuna? Because he pleased Krishna. No, because that's exactly right. Because you do it to please Krishna. And unless you can please Krishna, you're not going to get into the spiritual world. Haritoshanam, by pleasing Krishna. The whole thing is service. You cannot get into the spiritual world unless you develop a service attitude. And in the Grihastha Ashram, you're going to have plenty of opportunity to serve. Nobody's going to get into the spiritual world unless you can serve. The whole problem, that's why we're in the material world, because we think we should be served. We think we're the center. We think we're important. That's our disease. We have this very deep disease. But to get into the spiritual, if you read like in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, the whole atmosphere in the spiritual world is very different. And we can't add, the reason we got thrown out is because we didn't want to serve Krishna.
The whole, that, service
can be done in other ashrams also. But that's the main ashram is the Grihastha Ashram. Brahmacharis came from the Grihastha Ashram. Sannyasis came from the Grihastha Ashram. Prabhupada, let's go to the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita here. Sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. The importance of the Grihastha Ashram. Prabhupada gave a very nice explanation about he mentions about how if it wasn't for the okay. Can't find it immediately, but he describes about when Prabhupada, Krishna explains about when the yogis fall down, and they fall. There we go. That when the yogis fall down, they have to take birth in different families, and Srila Prabhupada explains that it is, where would somebody like Srila Prabhupada or Bhaktisiddhanta take birth if there wasn't for the Grihastha Ashram? That's the importance of the Grihastha Ashram, so that the advanced yogis can have a place to take birth. In fact, Indradumya Swami was telling me how he's, because, having to take birth again and to do preaching, he wants to make sure he takes birth in a very nice Grihastha family, so he's been really pushing, he's become very concerned about the Grihastha Ashram. So the Grihastha Ashram is the most important of all the ashrams, actually. Because they support everybody else. The Grihastha support the Brahmacharis, the Grihastha support the Sannyasis and the Vanaprasthas. The Grihasthas who are support the whole society. So that's why it's the most important ashram in many respects. That's called Grihamedi. The difference between Grihastha and Grihamedi. The Grihastha in the Grihastha Ashram, that's the Grihastha Ashrama. Ashrama means a place where spiritual life is cultivated. Whereas a Grihamedi, it's not called the Grihamedi Ashram. It's just that the Griha is the center. But the Grihastha Ashrama, it's the place where spiritual life is cultivated in the home. That's a great difference. Like Srila Prabhupada explained about his father. His father was a pure devotee. And how his father would go do business. And how he would, he would do puja in the morning, he would do puja in the evening. He said, my father's real business was doing puja. He just had a cloth business just to bring in some money to support the family and support his doing his main business of puja. But the family life was centered on Krishna. That's how Srila Prabhupada imbibed his Krishna consciousness directly from his father. So now if his father had been some mundane person, not interested in spiritual life, then it would have been a very different situation. So there is a difference between a Grihastha and a Grihamedi. That is the distinction. hopefully the power will come on soon enough. Anyway, Mataji, does that answer your question, even though I can't see you? Does that answer your question? Okay. That there's a distinction between Grihamedi and Grihastha. Hold. Let me just aim the if I can see what you have.
So is it important for a grihastha to have kids?
To have children?
Yes.
Well, as Chanakya Pandit says, putrahina griha shunyam, that if the a house with no children becomes zero. There's many reasons. You know, from a karmakandiya perspective, son is required. You know, if we're not following karmakanda, so that's not required from that karmakanda, so that the forefathers are saved from hell. That's not required for us. But there would be other reasons for having children, like in the case of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he personally prayed to have a ray of Vishnu born into his family. So that's one perspective. Just from a material perspective. From a material perspective, having children, you know, who's going to take care of you when you're, you know, just speaking from a material perspective, who's going to take care of you when you're old? The government? The government of India is going to take care of you when you're old? You're going to count on the government of India? The government's not going to take care of you when you're old, but your children. Hopefully. The government of India definitely will not take care of you. Children, hopefully they'll take care of you. There's a good chance. There's no guarantee, but there's a good chance. But there's a perfectly guarantee that the government of India will not take care of you when you're old.
But really that should not
unless you invested in very good mutual funds.
But that should not be the reason to have kids.
I said at the beginning, from material perspective. Material perspective, children are the natural caretakers of the parents when they get older. Yeah, somebody old has to take care of you when you're older. You know. So I said, from a material perspective, Krishna has this whole arrangement. When you're the parent takes care of the child when they're young, and later the child takes care of the parent. Prabhupada took care of his father when he was older. That's the duty of the child. That's also the duty of the child to take care of the parents. That's how Dasarath was cursed, because he killed the only child of that couple in the forest. He was cursed because of that he would die from separation from his son. So that's from one perspective, that's Krishna's natural way, that when you're older, you're taken care of. You know, this, Krishna did set up this system. You know that. So that's one reason. The other reason is that having children, we should pray, and we should to bring the grihasthas, that they can bring in to the world elevated souls. You know, wouldn't it be nice to have another Bhakti Siddhanta born into ISKCON, another Srila Prabhupada? That would be pretty good. At least I think so. I would certainly would be happy if I could have a child like that. Somebody who would be a very good, but it's only possible if you have children. That's the only way it can be done, is if you have children. And of course you take chances, because you might not be. Like in the case of Advaita Chandra. Advaita Charya had 6 children. 3 were pure devotees. 3 were not. 3 were Advaitins. They became Mayavadis. So, yeah. And he is God. Of course, we're all the children of God. Right? So, and we're all bad. Is it Krishna's fault? So you have to try your best, and then the rest is what your karma is. You have to do your best, and you get the credit for that. I just was reading that yesterday. Krishna said to Vidura that if a person tries their very level best to do something and fail, they still get the credit, spiritual credit for it. They still get the punya, even if they fail. He's like Jatayu, he failed. But is he criticized? No. He's a glorious person. So it'd be generally it's beneficial to have. That's a great bhakti program.
But, yeah. But it is not necessary.
But then why get married? Then why get married?
Okay. At that time,
why get married then?
At that time we got married because of lust. Now we are thinking like by not having children we can avoid so many responsibilities.
Avoid so many responsibilities. Trying to avoid responsibilities. Then we'll have. Then who will be responsible for it? Well, you could think that way, I suppose. But it's usually easier to, if you can do that without breaking the principles. But you know, if you can do that, then you become vanaprasthas after your third year of marriage. Okay, if you can do that, but then what will happen? See, in reality, what happens? I'm citing from, you know, because of my position as an astrologer, I get so many cases come to me. So here's one case, just like he's saying, one of my godbrothers. In fact, I performed a marriage ceremony with four couples in 1984, four married simultaneously. So he was not very well off, and he told his wife that I can't afford, he had a good job, you know, we won't even afford having children, so we won't have children. And they didn't consummate their marriage. And she agreed with it at the time. But then, 22 years later, when she was in her late 40s and freaking out because she didn't have any children, she went completely crazy. She left him, divorced him, to find somebody who will give her children at age 48, when it's almost impossible for a woman to have children. But she just freaked out. She couldn't handle it. That's a real life situation. That's a real case. Generally, so not in every instance, women like to have children. You know. The form determines the function. The female form is designed to create children. That's just the way God planned it. Some women, they don't like, but the vast majority of children women like to have children. So she said, she also agreed with it, but then she freaked out. She couldn't handle it. She just went, you know, she just went crazy. Literally, she went very, because obviously, how is a 48-year-old woman going to get children? She should have thought about it earlier. Or another case, this God sister of mine, she was 38. She told me when she was 30, she didn't want to have children. Then now she's 38, the clock is ticking. Now she was really wanted to have children. She was like desperate to have children. So the man may think that way, and the woman may even say it, but deep down in their heart, the vast majority of women, healthy, you know, there may be certain cases who don't, but most women want to have children, and then there's going to be a problem later when that need, that function, especially as the age gets further on and the biological clock starts ticking, they get very upset. They get anxious. So then what? That's just what happens. That's biology. It's biology. Is it true, ladies? Women, do most ladies want to have children? There they are. There's Pramana is right there. You can convince them that they don't want to, but in reality, they do. That's the reality. You know, the reality is they want to have children. And don't trust them if they say they don't. Because they do. That's like, that was the unfortunate case of this, my godbrother. That, you know, he found out too late that she actually wanted to have children. it was a very big tragedy for him.
Probably one case can come in this regard, like one of the person wants and another person says, no, I don't want. How to handle? What should be the, like?
They should have discussed this before getting married. Well, it depends who it is. Like, you know, Pandu wanted to have children, and his wife didn't want to because the whole situation means that she would have had to do by niyoga, by somebody else. So then he convinced her, and she did, because it was according to Dharma. You know, he convinced.
Who will win? You say both the cases, husband wants and the wife doesn't want.
Well, then if the wife wants, then if that case, then the wife should do it because she has to obey the instruction of her husband. That's her duty, to obey the instruction of her husband.
Okay, now the wife wants and husband doesn't want.
Well, then then she has to think about how will his wife be protected when he's not there, because the duty of the son to protect the wife, and if he doesn't give her children, how she will be protected? Who will protect the wife when she's older? What if he's not there? How will she be protected? It's also that, you know, that's another consideration, that she should be protected in her older age. Who will protect the woman? Now that, you know, I read some tragic things, you know, like some, I read what is long, about 12 years ago, but some man, he took his mother for a ride in Delhi or something. He dropped her off in the park, and she thought it was just going to be for half an hour, and then he just drove away, and he just dumped his mother off, never, just to just get rid of her, and want to take care of his mother. Irresponsible, because she's just a burden. So, even Duryodhan took care of his mother, even though his mother said he should be killed. Everybody said Duryodhan should be killed. Only Dhritarashtra didn't agree. But you know, that's the kind of thing that should have been discussed before marriage. To find out these things after marriage is a little, you know. That's why certain things can, these certain problems can be eliminated by proper, you know, by proper compatibilities and, you know, arranging before. Letting people know what's expected before the marriage, not that they find out after the marriage. And this is not, you know, Krishna's Vedic culture, this was common. Prenuptial agreements were common. They made arrangements ahead of time. Like the case of Dasarath and Satyavati, prenuptial agreement was there. Bhishma could not become king. Or Arjuna and Chitrangada, the princess of Manipur, there was an arrangement. Any child born would become the son of the king, not Arjuna's son, because he didn't have a son. The king didn't have a son, so it would become his son. So the kind of prenuptial agreements. So ahead of marriage, you find these things out, not after the marriage. And any other business, any other transaction, you find out what, right? It's a marriage contract. You find out whether this particular is in a contract. Any other thing you do, right? You're going to buy a computer, you want to know what is the contract. You get married, this also. You should find out what's going on. That's a pretty important contract. Right? But you have to, but it's each in particular case. Okay, so suppose if the woman is unhealthy, she can't have children. That's another, you know. Now in that kind of a situation, according to Manu, then the man could get another wife. But according to the Marriage Act of 1958, you can't do that now. Though men still do it. They still do that in India, though it's illegal. Because they won't have children, so they'll get another wife. Any other questions? One other point is that sometimes, I mean, this discussion could go on for a long time. There's so many points to cover, but sometimes the husband may ask the wife to do something which is adharmic. Should the wife do it? Huh? Should the wife do it? What do you think? What do you think, Mataji? What if your husband asks you to do something which is like the case, my god sister, she went to Srila Prabhupada because she was an Agarwal from Vrindavan. And I only found out anyway, she went to Srila Prabhupada and she said, because she was a devotee and her husband was not a devotee. And her husband didn't want to follow any regulated principles. So therefore he wanted, you know, sex whenever he wanted sex. I don't know if he was a vegetarian or not. So she asked Srila Prabhupada, what should I do? So Srila Prabhupada said, you should do what your mother trained you to do, serve your husband. Don't leave your husband. Do whatever he wants to do. So why is that? Why would he do something like that? Because Krishna explains in 18th chapter, verse 47, This is the only instruction he repeats twice. Actually, there's two instructions he repeats twice. This is one of them. It is better to engage in one's own occupation, even though one may perform it imperfectly, than to accept another's occupation and perform it perfectly. Duties prescribed according to one's nature are never affected by sinful reaction. So she would not get any sinful reaction. Her consciousness might be disturbed, but she gets no sinful reaction. Just like if her husband said, feed me meat. So she may not like cutting the meat, may make her sick, but she would get no sinful reaction. So her consciousness may be disturbed by having to deal with dead bodies. Like Srila Prabhupada's sister. That's a case. Imagine, Mataji, in your mind's eye, that your husband's a meat eater. Right? And further, envision in your mind's eye that your husband's also a drunkard. Then, imagine in your mind's eye that your husband also spends more time with prostitutes than with you. And further, imagine that whatever money left over, he gambles. Now, would that be a little difficult for you? That was the case of Srila Prabhupada's sister. That was her situation. So she came, she was also his god sister. Her name was Bhava Tarini. She was first initiated by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta. I can't remember who her second initiation was by, one of Prabhupada's god brothers. When she came, that was her situation. Of course, they knew at the beginning that he was a mediator. Srila Prabhupada described that when she, after the marriage, and she went to the house of her father-in-law, she started crying because she never saw dead fish before. She started crying, and her mother-in-law said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Oh, I've never seen it." "Oh, don't worry, you don't have to eat these things, you know." But then her husband became a complete rogue. Complete rogue. So she came to Srila Prabhupada, asked for advice, what should I do? My husband does this, he does this, so many bad things. And that was like in the, you can imagine, like, you know, 1920s in India. Today, nobody would say much. But oh, they might say a few things. But then, 100 years ago, you know, in the 1920s, that was like a major scandal. That would be like major, really bad. So Srila Prabhupada, he didn't say, you know, go to the women's ministry or, you know, get a good lawyer or get marriage counseling. He didn't say anything like that. He didn't say argue with your husband. He didn't say criticize. He said, you take the deities of Radha Krishna that we had when we were children. You worship them every day. You pray for the benefit of your husband. And you just serve your husband. That's all. Just do that. Don't argue with them. Don't fight with them. Just pray for his benefit and serve your husband. You know, material problem, spiritual solution. So she did that. And he didn't say try it for 3 months. He didn't say try, you know, no time limit. Just do that. And she did that. It didn't happen immediately. But after some time, her husband saw that this woman has only my best interest at heart. He became totally changed. He became her devotee. He was devoted, totally devoted to his wife. Why? Because she went to, you know, to the highest authority, to Radha and Krishna. Like one devotee in England, he's the top book distributor in England. Nobody could even come close to him. He said, what is his secret of distributing books? He says, I outnumber my opponent. Me and my super soul and his super soul against him. He's outnumbered 3-1. So that's what she did. He was outnumbered. He couldn't resist. But it didn't happen overnight. She had great faith in her brother and in Radha and Krishna. Because what's the other alternative? So then she leaves the husband. Then that's a possibility. If it becomes intolerable, then the wife can leave. But no remarriage. There's no remarriage. If it's, you know, just like in the case of Amoga. When Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya told his daughter to leave, you're a widow now, don't go with your husband anymore. Because he was a great aparadhi. I mean, there are certain instances in Manu where a wife can reject the husband, but it has to be for something extremely serious, like where a crime, Allah Mahapatika, a crime by which he loses his caste. You know, there was one instance, or like a fraud at the time of marriage. If there's fraud before, like they say one thing and then that's not what the fact is. Like there's one case where the girl found out shortly after marriage that her husband was continually having a long-standing affair with another woman who happened to be his aunt. In other words, he's having sex with his aunt. So that's, first there's fraud, that was not disclosed at the time of marriage, and second of all, having sex with your aunt is a mahapatika, a crime by which a person loses his caste. So in such a case, she can reject her husband and remarry without any blemish. But that's not going to be something that happens on a day-to-day basis. That's a very rare, hopefully. It's a rare thing. But those kind of things can be there. Or if the husband, you know, like at the time of marriage, then the wife finds out that the husband is impotent. Or, you know, she's young and the husband's impotent. So then, because that wasn't disclosed, so then she can remarry. But these are not ordinary. These are like very unusual circumstances.
But if one talk or Srila Prabhupada is explaining, the wife should not serve a husband who is fallen.
That's in chapter 20, that's in verse 29. But fallen is, you know, oh, he doesn't chant his round, you know, fallen is something very serious, not that she just doesn't agree with him. You know, it depends what the definition of fallen is. You know, fallen is something very serious, like a mahapatika. He's having an affair with his aunt. That's pretty fallen. That's a very fallen situation. But there's no remarriage. I mean, in that case, because, you know, if they annul the marriage. But if she could, of course, decide to, if the wife had accepted, knowing that, then she can't, you know, when she finds out and she rejects the husband, that's one thing. But if she agrees, knowing now what's going on, then she can't remarry, because she knows now. So in which case she'd have to go and stay with her father. But you know, as long as the husband's not fallen. But in other situations we see like Mandodari, her husband was fallen, but she served him. But she served him very nicely. She tried to save him from offending Sita. She protected Sita.
Would it like you dealt with one case like this example, the wife is totally fallen. Like husband is not following the regulated principle and the wife has to serve husband.
Yeah.
The other case can be like wife is not following her vows. Then what should the husband do in that situation?
They'd have to see the exact circumstances, and you know, according to what Manu says, then you know, if the wife is hostile to the husband, then she can be rejected, like is the case in the Ramayana. Kaikeyi's mother, Sumitra, brought up the point. Sumantra brought up the point that Kaikeyi was just like her mother. Her mother, what happened was that her father had the siddhi given by a rishi, that he could understand the secret, that he could understand the language of animals. But the stipulation was he could not divulge what the animals were saying or he would die immediately. That was the other side of the gift. He could understand what they were saying, but if he revealed what they said, he would die. So one time he was in the bedroom with his wife and they were relaxing, lounging, and he started laughing. He started laughing. And she thought, well, why is he laughing? Is he laughing at me? She became, because she was a princess, a little bit arrogant, she thought that he's laughing at her. And she said, why are you laughing at me? He said, I'm not laughing at you. He says, those birds said something hilarious. Very funny. She said, no, you're laughing at me. He says, no, I'm not. He said, well, how do I know? He says, this rishi, I know, I have this gift, But tell me what they said. Well, I can't tell you what they said because if I do, I'll die. He says, I don't care if you die. She said, I don't care if you die. Tell me. And he was shocked. He said, she didn't care if he died. So he immediately went to the rishi who gave him the siddhi and said, what should I do in this case? He says, she doesn't care if you die. You can just reject her immediately. She doesn't care if you die. Reject her. So he rejected his wife because she was antagonistic to him. Like that. She's going to die and she doesn't care. that's why Sumantra said the same thing to Kaikeyi. You're just like your mother. You're killing your husband. She killed her husband. She killed Dasaratha. Well, it becomes complicated. You have to check to see, according to Shastra, if it's serious enough. Like the case of my god sister, Prabhupada said, just serve your husband. So what happened was that other god sisters were telling, oh, your husband's just a demon, he's not a devotee, you should reject him, you should divorce him. So Srila Prabhupada wasn't there, so she became under peer pressure, so she divorced her husband and she got remarried. And the last thing she told me, I haven't seen her, she died after that, the last thing she told me is, to this day I regret disobeying Srila Prabhupada. To this day I regret. She divorced her husband and got remarried. And the Prabhupada told her not to. Just do. If he wants liquor, serve him liquor. If he wants to have sex, wants to eat meat. Otherwise, then she'll have to be out in the street.
What about the conjugal situation? Like he was asking it. Can a husband be in a similar situation where you said that the wife has to follow the vows of the husband, but the husband, of course, how long can one be compassionate? To what extent should one be compassionate and keep?
You mean the wife following the vows of the husband?
No, the husband, the wife is not following the vows of the husband. How long can the husband be compassionate in the sense? Because being compassionate eventually can help the person progress in Krishna consciousness also. So to what extent?
Now we're talking about somebody. This is before. The people were married before they became devotees or after they became devotees? You're talking about a specific case or a hypothetical case?
Simple.
A hypothetical? Why, your wife is not a devotee?
She's not a devotee.
Oh, okay, so you have...
Actually, we've been separate for about 1 year. Now I've just requested her to come back. She's coming back. So still have,
well, there's different situations. Like my wife was telling me about one situation she knew of in England. They were Indian couple living in England. So he became a devotee and she didn't become a devotee. So he was working in the temple He's very humble. But then his wife was really upset that she was a that he was a devotee. And she was really upset with him to the point that one day she attacked him, physically attacked him, scratched up. Then she called the police and he got arrested. He spent 2 nights in jail because of that. She falsely accused him of attacking her. So he didn't do anything. He just continued supporting the family. And now he's totally shocked. Now she's coming to the temple. Now she's chanting. So like that, that's a rare case. Sometimes that doesn't happen. In his case, he's lucky. He's very surprised. His wife actually became a devotee. But this depends on what the time limit is. He was, in fact, when he found out that she was getting married, he said, "Don't get married. Do not get married." He was, "Don't get married," because he went through hell. His wife attacks him, has him thrown in jail. False accusations. So many horrible things happened to him from his wife, and now she's become a devotee. So, you have to see what your limits are. See what the limitations are. How long, you can try to do your best, but then, in that kind of a situation, it's very difficult to see what happens. As long as your wife doesn't become an impediment to devotional service, then you can stay. Why not stay married? As Prabhupada explains in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, verses 8 to 12, long as the family's not an impediment, then there's no problem. But if she becomes an impediment, then you have a difficulty then. If she's antagonistic, very antagonistic, then, like even in the case of Srila Prabhupada, his wife, she was a devotee, but at the same time antagonistic, like she sold his, the breaking straw was when she sold his, traded his Bhagavatam for an equal weight of tea biscuits. Then he left her. But they had been married for 30 years or something like that, 35, long time. So that was...
Guruji, you're explaining, if the husband is not following anything, and the wife has to follow, serve the husband. Now, in this case, the wife is not following, then husband has no duty?
And the wife has different material desires which she wants satisfied from the husband? Well, the husband should try to, because he can't do things unilaterally, because it just depends on the situation. Everything is, each situation is unique and how you would deal with it. See how you would deal with that. If after a certain length of time you can see it's not getting anywhere, then you have to be concerned for your own spiritual life. What does Chanakya Pandit say, For the benefit of the family, you can sacrifice one member. For the benefit of the village, you can sacrifice one family. For the benefit of the country, you can sacrifice a village. And for the welfare of the soul, you can sacrifice everything. But you should try as best you can. It just depends on how much... you haven't been living with her for a year, you said, right? You said you've been separated for a year?
Yeah, I was back in March, so I'm a bit concerned. How do I get
to the place? What was the reason of separation?
ISKCON.
Why? She's more favorable now?
Yeah, she's now live and let live.
Okay. How long you had been married before you became a devotee?
I'd only gotten ISKCON, I wasn't very serious. So about 5-6 months later I got married.
She didn't know about that.
She didn't know.
She didn't know you had another family. Yeah. Well, it just depends, how her... Like with my family, my personal family, I don't preach to my family. Because I learned very quickly that the prophet is not appreciated in his own village. So I just live my life. I cook for them. I give a lot of prasadam, and they appreciate that. So then when they ask, then I live my own life, If they ask me a question, then I preach to them because they asked me something. So, you know, you can, in your own family, then you can be a good example. Be nice. Don't try to push. You know, be exemplary. Now the fact you have conjugal relations, that's going to be a bit more tricky because you're married. So you have to see, you know, that's going to be more tricky. It is beneficial. These are the tricky parts. Is the tricky parts of married life. So I try to have these things. You didn't realize that you were going to become more serious in Krishna consciousness before you got married. No,
yeah,
an unexpected thing.
Getting more and more serious.
So any other questions? It's getting a little bit late now. Almost 10:30. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare.